Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Studying Media Critically, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm your host, Gomo Claire, and today I'm joined by Onamik Saha, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Media, Communications and Cultural Studies at Goldsmiths University of London. We'll be talking about his excellent new book, Race, Culture and Media, which was published in 2021. Welcome to the show, Onamik.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I guess, can we start off with a bit of biographical background? Could you tell us a little bit about your academic and kind of professional path into scholarship?
I'm assuming quickly, briefer. I grew up in Northeast London, not far from where I am now. And I studied media and communication at Goldsmiths, actually, where I work now as an undergrad. And I picked that course because I thought I was going to be really interested, my interest predominantly. And they were genuinely. I wanted to make stuff. I was interested in making film, TV shows, kind of being creative. But the nature of the course was that half of it is spent teaching practice, but the other half was teaching theory. And at the time, I didn't realize this. But at the time, I was being taught by, you know, short of Stuart Hall, like the founding figures of British cultural studies. Again, this is not something I really, when I applied, I had no idea. I don't think I knew what cultural studies was. And then all of a sudden, I was kind of attending classes by these brilliant people, taught by these brilliant people that were referring to other, you know, the work of other, you know, influential kind of figures in that tradition. And I was like, oh God, I can write essays on this stuff. So this is quite personal, but my undergraduate dissertation was called Asians Can't Rock. And basically it was about British South Asians who play in guitar bands, especially in the genre of like indie rock and punk, which are, you know, very, very white genres, historically white genres. And, you know, I was a fan of this music and I was playing in bands in this scene. And so I was given the opportunity, you know, cultural studies and learning and being a student at Goldsmiths gave me the opportunity to actually think about and explore some of the issues I felt being in that scene. You know, kind of, really crude questions like, I get kind of teased by my Asian mates for being into this kind of music. You know, am I just assimilating into white culture? But at the same time, when I go to these gigs and play in these bands, I'm often the only person of color. And that's a weird experience. I don't know why. No, I'm not experiencing explicit racism, but it doesn't, you know, I don't really feel a part of it like some of my mates do. And also, why is this, you know, how have other Asians in a similar position kind of, you know, performed, and what has been the politics and aesthetics of their music, and how, you know, and through that I learned about how culture is the, and media is the sphere where, you know, dominant ideas around race as well as gender, sexuality, class and so on get reproduced, but also for space where we can challenge them, which ties in nicely to this book, which is kind of, you know, explores all of those issues in a much grander scale. You know, back then I was very interested in British South Asian experience, especially those people who work in the media. That became my PhD project, looking at other British South Asians and their experiences of working in media. And I wasn't just interested in, and again, this kind of goes back to like my my punk DIY roots. I wasn't just interested in the representations of stories and characters they were creating in their narratives, but I was also really interested in how they were getting their stories out there. You know, what kind of modes of production were they using? You know, it's what relationship, you know, often in different settings, whether that was like public service broadcasting, whether that was in a corporate setting, or whether it was in a really kind of DIY independent underground kind of sense as well, which, you know, I wasn't naive enough to say that that existed outside of capitalism, but it, you know, at times those modes of production could be explicitly, if not anti-capitalist, certainly anti-commercial and anti-corporate. So that's how all my kind of interests kind of coalesce. And then from the PhD, I kind of, yeah, developed this interest in cultural industries and media industries. So how media works. And that's something that I've followed, that's followed through throughout my work. And as I say, you know, Race, Culture and Media, this latest book is an opportunity to really kind of pull all of those different strands together from like production, politics, representation, but also, you know, consumption and audiences, which is something I hadn't really researched, but at the moment the influence of the audience is really kind of I won't say radically altering, but it's having an impact on production in a way that I don't think has really happened in the history of modern media. And that, I think that is thanks to social media, which is, I'm sure, something we'll talk about shortly. So yeah, that's kind of a little brief rundown of where I got to, where I am now.
And the book has because it builds on, you know, your previous book, Race and the Cultural Industries, but this one, as you say, expands the, I guess, areas of media, so to include consumption and audiences a bit more, but also has a textbook format. So could you tell us a bit about like any specific challenges or interesting experiences in writing in this kind of mode?
Yeah. I was invited by the good people at Sage to write this book. Actually, while I was finishing off Race in the Culture Industry, so it's been in the pipeline for a while now. And hey, look, let's be upfront about this. There's, you know, textbooks have a particular standing, don't they? And I'm sorry to say, and I think I've probably been guilty of this in the past, you know, there's a snobbishness towards these books, which are, you know, designed to be accessible, designed specifically for learning and teaching, right? And so so they're not really seen as creating new knowledge as such or driving new arguments. Rather, they, you know, they're often a synthesis. They're designed to be a synthesis of all the literature in the field. And you know, I think the kind of most successful textbooks in that regard are the ones that, you know, can really speak to student needs directly, including kind of relevant case studies and so on. Often they have kind of little details, like, you know, a kind of a box where you can kind of highlight a specific theory or thinker, or like, you know, discussion points at the end of each chapter, which can then feed a seminar discussion. So, for instance, so. So obviously these are really valuable and, and, you know, they can sell quite well as well. That's not the reason I wrote it, obviously, but, you know, they are mass produced, right? Relatively mass produced. But I was thinking about some of my, favorite textbooks, and I kind of realized how they meant more to me in terms of how I kept on referring back to them. They would introduce me to a field, but also my favorite ones were actually built around arguments and were producing new knowledge. I always, you know, I really respect the work in the field of like critical race kind of studies, broadly conceived. I really respect the work of people like John Solomos and Les Back, who write about, you know, kind of really important, written or edited, really important kind of textbooky type books that cover, you know, provide really brilliant, insightful overviews of really complex theories. More in the cultural industries vein, the book Culture Industries by David Hesmanach was a huge influence. And, you know, that is a book that's referred to by everyone in the field, whether students or kind of, you know, the biggest research names or whatever. in the key figures in the field. I also really liked my colleague Aaron Davis. As I was writing this book, his book Promotional Culture came out, and that was another book I tried to emulate. So it's a textbook, and what I really love about it, and this is like my whole ethos around writing, is to try and make things as accessible as possible. As I say to my students, you know, who try and write academically in inverted commas, you know, you're already dealing with really complex theories and ideas and concepts. So our task as, you know, scholars, for want of a better word, is to try and communicate those complex theories and ideas in the most, you know, accessible way. And you can't really do that by dumbing down, but we can definitely do it through our language and trying to write it with clarity and precision. So that was always my ethos in everything I write. I like to think that my work isn't actually that difficult to read. And so that carried through into this textbook, and I really enjoyed writing in that mode even more, you know, writing in that mode, thinking of students and researchers. But then also what I learned from the textbooks that had influenced me and had shaped my research, my work, was, you know, I wanted it to be based around an argument. You know, I wanted to try and bring together different perspectives that haven't maybe gone together as neatly in the past, but to try it out and to build an argument around race, culture, and media. And so I think I did actually speak to David Hesman-Houch about this, about Culture Institutes, and he described it as a research-led textbook. And I think that's, yeah. So yeah, if I can inspire, God, I don't want to sound so grand, but if this book can inspire, you know, other people that this is actually a format that can really do interesting things. Before I labour this point even more, but, you know, writing those case studies and coming up with discussion points actually was a really, really useful exercise. It really kind of showed the issues at stake in a way that maybe a traditional research book doesn't. You know, sometimes we can get a little bit, you know, we can go down a rabbit hole, can't we? And sometimes the clarity isn't always there. Why we started writing this book in the first place, it's, you know, sometimes it's not always that clear. So I actually really enjoyed writing in this mode, even though I had some misgivings about it when I started.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a really impressive scope and clarity without sacrificing depth, given quite how much you have to cover and have to engage with. So, no, I think that's definitely the case. So moving on to the kind of new knowledge bit, I guess, you know, the book's topped and tailed with you laying out a theoretical framework which kind of synthesizes aspects of the critical political economy approach to media, post-colonial studies and cultural studies, and you call this the post-colonial cultural economy. So could you lay out what this means in practice?
Yeah, so it's basically, so this notion of post-colonial cultural economy is to basically trying to capture like the different dimensions at the micro, meso and micro level that shape how, as I put it in this book, how media make race. So that's the kind of question, how media make race. And that's a kind of a slight shift from how media represents race, which is often the kind of question a lot of us work with, you know, thinking about how particular, you know, racial and ethnic groups are represented by media and the extent to which this is accurate or authentic or correct, you know, and all of those words I put in inverted in scare quotes because they're highly contested, right? And so how media make race, I feel like, captures better what is happening in the realm of race culture. I mean, this is what media does. It makes ideas of race that then shape society's, you know, understandings of different racial and ethnic others. So, you know, this is a very, you know, spoiler alert, Gummo, there's a few references to Stuart Hall in this book. It's hard not to. But like I say, post-colonial cultural economy is a way, it kind of, you know, in a way builds on the famous circuit of culture, you know, production, representation, identity. I wish I didn't start this because now I'm going to forget what the others are. Policy, identity. I think I've maybe repeated myself. Anywho, it's a bit of an extension of that, but it's thinking more about different layers. So the macro, the meso, and the micro level. So the macro would include, you know, thinking about how legacies of empire still play a huge role in terms of how we understand race, race as an idea, race as a concept, which then materializes into the experiences of those who have been racialized. Also, you can't, you know, you're talking about the media, you've got to look at the political economy of media, right? And who owns it, you know, kind of issues of concentration, media concentration and conglomeration, the extent to which that inevitably reduces diversity or not, actually, is the case. You know, and then of course now with social media, the way that global tech companies are, you know, the huge players now in the media landscape, and are monetizing content that we make for free, essentially. So those are the kind of macro dimensions. And already I'm touching on cultural studies, I'm touching on post-colonial studies, but also critical political economy, you know. And there was a time where, you know, never the twain should meet, you know. In that, you know, there was this very, in the 80s and 90s, there was this crude opposition created between cultural studies and political economy approaches. So immediately I'm going to do away with that. Thankfully that the debate doesn't really happen on those terms anymore, but there's still, I think we, you know, more can be done in bridging those different approaches together in order to better understand how capitalism and racism are working together in order to shape media making practices. At the meso level, we're looking at organizations. So who are the people making media? You know, so, you know, whether that's film studios, major record labels and publishing houses, through to, you know, independent producers, whether, you know, I'm really interested in like the new forms of like black and brown, even in the context of Britain, you know, the new kind of platforms run by young black, brown, Asian people, especially journalists, who are kind of becoming the new, you know, emerging as a new generation of cultural critics and creating their own platforms and creating content for their own communities. Communities that have historically been marginalized. I mean, at the micro level, it's about, yeah, like looking at the everyday experiences of media, including questions of consumption and the politics of that. And, you know, it's one of the, you know, the crude, the one of the kind of critique, if I can go back to that political economy versus cultural studies debate, you know, one of the most reductive arguments made against cultural studies and especially audience studies was that they were suggesting that audiences hold all the power, but that was never their intention. Audience studies scholars were never saying that they held all the power, but nonetheless, they were pointing to the ways in which consumption is highly complex, and that actually by looking at the complexity of consumption, of how we consume media, it also develops a really much more nuanced understanding of the operations of ideology. And how ideology works. So that's what the post-colonial cultural economy is trying to do, is to actually think about all of those different levels, as well as the different areas, production, representation, and consumption. Trying to produce a framework, which, as you kind of highlight, draws from critical political economy, cultural studies, post-colonial studies, and so on. So yeah, that's what I attempted to do. And yeah, and the first half of the book kind of outlines those different approaches.
Yeah, and so the front half is really well laid out, talking about how you are getting them to speak to each other, and then you're kind of pointing out some of the shortcomings of each different approach. One that interested me, I think, in chapter two was you talk about some of the limitations or absences in the critical cultural approach to race regarding affect, emotion, and feeling. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about what like attending to those features adds to any kind of analysis of race in the media.
If anything, actually, I feel like I could have developed some of those ideas more. I think there's some really interesting research being done on that, and more research needs to be done, actually, particularly in regard to kind of media practices amongst like racialized communities. You know, there's one of the big tendencies that I wanted to kind of critique straight away is something that I see a lot, especially on social media, and I think it's really problematic, but there's a tendency to kind of the politics representation as it unfolds on social media, and Gavin Titley writes really brilliantly on this, is that they often take really reductive terms in terms of whether this representation of black character is correct or not, or authentic or not, or stereotypical or biased, you know. And the big part of the book is kind of dispelling those terms that we often use to frame our discussions on representation. one of the other problems of, as well, of just this focus on representation, which is basically, you know, the primary way in which kind of race and media has been explored through the politics of representation, as Stuart Hall calls it, is that sometimes it can have it can be based upon too straightforward account of ideology. So this particular representation, you know, reproduces Orientalist ideologies or discourse, wherever you want to work with, of, you know, let's say, you know, kind of Middle Eastern people or Muslim people. And sometimes that doesn't do justice to the ways in which we take meaning and pleasure and from media we consume, and also how actually that can galvanize us and empower us in ways that are not as tangible. So it's not like I watch a superhero movie featuring a South Asian man as the, you know, the lead superhero, and all of a sudden I feel empowered, you know, as a South Asian cis man. I don't think media really works like that. And how often do we watch stuff that, you know, is really bad and we know that it's problematic, but we can still get something from it? And it's not, that's about pleasure, right? And that's about pleasure and how pleasure is produced. But also it's about how those, like the effect of particular media texts can produce forms of, like, you know, collective flourishing, you know, and music's a really good example of that. Like music with it in, especially in its most non-semiotic forms, like dance music, for instance, where the lyrics are, you know, literally, I love you, baby, repeated over and over again. But nonetheless, in a particular context, listening to that music can really have powerful effects, right? In terms of the kind of forms of solidarity engenders in that particular space, you know, whether it's a dance floor or even, like, you know, watching a movie together or creating content together. You know, these emotions, affects and pleasure, you know, they're really important parts of it, which go beyond the question of representation often and what's being represented. And so I think that's something that is neglected. To be fair, I don't think the book probably develops that as much as it could have done. Maybe, you know, maybe I can point to the dearth of research on that, but maybe that's actually my own shortcomings and something I'd need to kind of think about some more. But yeah, those are definitely underrated. And what it does is it kind of gets us out of that cul-de-sac of, like, is this representation right or not? You know, which I think, yeah, it's frustrating to see those reductive ways in which we tend to talk about media, especially in relation to race and cultural politics. And that's what this book is trying to shift, actually.
Yeah, and it's actually something I realised just reading the conclusion, where you mentioned that you've avoided any framing or even any engagement really with the notion of cultural appropriation. And I only realised then how refreshing it was not to have read anything about that in the rest of the book. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, you're dealing with representation elsewhere, but you realise exactly how reductive and how kind of a much of a cul-de-sac that kind of circumscribed understanding of representation can be. That's one kind of quite refreshing part of the book.
Yeah, and to go back to the original question about, you know, what a textbook can do, and that is, I think, an example of where, you know, that's what excited me, actually. I can kind of I don't want to sound like an egomaniac, but there's not many. There hasn't been a textbook on race, kind of culture, media, this kind of approach, you know, for a long time. And so the ability to kind of maybe take a stab of, like, trying to steer that, the ways in which this stuff is discussed, based on my own, you know, this isn't my own agenda. This is based on, you know, a very long period of research, and, you know, and I've challenged a lot of my own assumptions. I mean, the cultural appropriation argument, I mean, it's a fascinating one. And in some ways, and it's, you know, the ones that often generate the most discussion in class. And in some ways, maybe I did it, you know, maybe I was a little bit too dismissive, actually. But it's, you know, I was just trying to, yeah, shift the ways in which maybe we talk and explore these issues. And I don't want to give too much justice to approaches, or too much space to approaches, that I think actually part of the problem and why and limits our understandings of how race and culture works. For those who haven't read it, I'm not suggesting, you know, my kind of slight, I won't say dismissal, but my unease around the cultural appropriation argument is that, as much as we need to take very, very seriously the exploitation of culture and racialize others in the form of commodity culture by the dominant culture, by powerful groups, as much as we need to take that very, very seriously, when it's the problem with the cultural appropriation argument is that it turns into a question of ownership, right? This is, and private property, right? this is ours. You're not allowed to use it. And that is not how culture works. You know, fundamentally, that is not how culture works. So what I'm trying to do is think, get us to develop a much more nuanced understanding of, you know, the nature of that exploitation without which doesn't slip into, you know, kind of problematic notions of authenticity or, as I say, ownership. You know, the culture that we hold dear and that we kind of really, we stake so much on that we feel really does belong to our particular, let's just say community for now. Often those things are hybrid, mixed, mashup of all kinds of influences, internal and external as well as internal, you know. And so, as I say, that's not how culture works. So what I try and do with the book is, yeah, try and produce a more nuanced way to explore that exploitation of culture, which is a fact of cultural production, especially in the West.
Your mention of ownership there actually leads us on to your engagement with racial capitalism. And I thought maybe the best way into that would be the question that you raise in chapter four, which is media in the West more interested in extracting profit or sustaining racial hierarchies?
Last year I read, and this was something I noticed myself, and then Gal Dem inevitably, you know, were already on it, you know, and they wrote this brilliant, I can't remember the person who wrote it, but it was about post Black Lives Matter. It was about the kind of surge of like anti-racist nonfiction that was being pushed by publishers. Some of it was commissioned immediately after Black Lives Matter, but a lot of it was pushed immediately in Black Lives Matter's wake. There was this big push, and there was this famous moment, like this one week where, like, you know, the majority of the top 10 bestsellers were Black authors, or at least books on racism. And that would, you know, and you know, the publishing industry, which I've written about a lot, done a lot of research on the publishing industry, which is, I always think of Greg Dyke, the former director general of the BBC, when he described his own organization as hideously white. You know, he's at a Christmas party with all the managers, and he sees just a sea of whiteness. And the publishing industry has that same problem. And despite their best efforts, it's not changing. And so you've got this very, you know, research shows the whitest, if I can put it in these crude terms, the whitest culture industry, more than any others, pushing out all these books on anti-racist nonfiction. You can probably think of examples I'm thinking of. And that would suggest, and you know, to what extent are those books, I mean, these are very, publishers like to think of themselves as a very liberal bunch, but it does kind of start, you know, on the one hand, you can read that as really progressive. It's great that finally they're taking these books seriously and releasing them. But then there's the question of, well, what's happening to these books? Who's buying them, and where, and what, and how, what is the level of engagement? And then the other question as well is, like, you know, to what extent would the publishers been doing this if they weren't going to make a ton of money from it? So all of a sudden, anti-racism seems like, this is an argument, a notorious argument by Zizek, where he says anti-racism is actually very useful to capitalism, because what you're doing is that you're creating, you're bringing in kind of audiences that were once marginalized, who are becoming new market niches, right? Who you can target and commodify and sell products to. So it helps capitalism expand once all these marginalized groups are brought into the economy, into the market. It's not as simple as that. Right. So racial capitalism, which very rarely, the discussions of which are very rarely touched on media, which I find really surprising, because like media is a really rich site in which to explore the cultural dynamics of racial capitalism in terms of, you know, the two big issues, if you like, the two big forms of exploitation. One is racism, racial oppression, subjugation, racial violence, and then there's capitalism, you know, the exploitation of the worker and so on and so forth. And what racial capitalism helps us understand is that racism and capitalism are two distinct historical forces, but they're intertwined. And together at different moments in history, that relationship defines how racial others are treated and are made in different moments in history. So again, I've like a really, I really enjoyed writing that chapter. I really enjoyed exploring racial capitalism in relation to media, because it kind of explains so much about what's going on with regards to the diversity of race, and especially commodification of race, apologies. And also, you know, diversity right now, the D word, you know, it's hard to escape, and it is defining so much of what we consume right now. The diversity agenda let me put it again, say it again. The diversity agenda is shaping so much of what we consume right now. Black, brown, white, Asian people, like everyone across the board. And so racial capitalism is a really useful theory for helping us think about what is happening there. Because it seems like a progressive shift. Isn't it great that there's more people of color? You know, isn't it great that there's people of color in period dramas now? You know, it's that wonderful thing. The whitest of the genres. I'm sorry about talking about these reductive terms. I'm trying to encourage people not to talk in such reductive, but you know, for period costume dramas, you know, historically, notoriously, the whitest of all the genres. And now all of a sudden, you know, you see black, brown, Asian people having a whale of a time, you know, on these shows. The characters are like all getting caught up in all kinds of romantic entanglements and, you know, misunderstandings and, you know, creating drama. But it's, what is actually going on here? What is driving this, and how? Right, I think that, you know, don't get me wrong. This is so amazing compared to, you know, an Asian lead on Bridgerton. When I was a kid growing up in the '80s in the UK, you know, never thought I'd see that. So there's something, you know, enabling and constraining going on, and racial capitalism is a really useful theory for helping us produce a critical account of what diversity is doing right now, which, as I say, is shaping so much of the media we consume right now.
And then thinking about this, the kind of cultural commodification of race, you identify like two different strands, right? Top down and bottom up. Yeah. And top down and bottom up reappear a couple of occasions throughout the book. So I wonder if you could kind of expand a bit on how you're distinguishing those dynamics.
Often commodification of race is often, as it's been, you know, Bell Hooks, I think, is probably the most famous proponent of that argument in her essay, Eating the Other. It's one of those essays I return. It's a set reading on the course I teach, and I return to it. I have an opportunity to return to it every year. And I always, it's one of those essays where you always pick up something new every time you revisit it. And it captures brilliantly the way the dynamics of the commodification of the other and what Bell Hooks does. Utilizing a black feminist perspective, she highlights the sexual, kind of a sexual dimensions to that, you know, literally eating the other. I mean, it's so provocative, just the very notion, right? And in doing so, she highlights the operations of what she famously calls white capitalist patriarchal society. See, all of the words, you know, capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, you know, all brought to bear in her analysis. So Bell Hooks talks about commodification of other and how, you know, the politics, any kind of radical potential of the cultural commodity is subsumed when it takes a commodity form. And she, you know, famously it takes to task like Public Enemy, you know, which seems kind of a little bit perverse talking about one of the greatest rap bands of all time. But she says, look, you know, your message, when you become a commodity, that message of like black power, when it takes commodity form, all of its politics is subsumed, you know. And she famously goes on to take on, you know, Beyonce later on and, you know, calls her a terrorist for the way in which she exploits herself and her sexuality and black sexuality in order to make surplus value or profit. But then, you know, my issue with that argument is that, one, it doesn't really, you know, is there a form of culture that exists outside of commodification, I guess, is the kind of question. I'm sure there are. Like very, you know, pure, fleeting moments where culture is, you know, kind of autonomous, purely autonomous from capitalism. But actually, for the most part, any kind of cultural expression that is shared on a mass level will have to take commodity form in some form. And that doesn't always have to, you know, reproduce capitalist ideology. And as we know, the best art and culture that we love and cherish the most often is precisely because it goes against the grain somehow. I'm not, you know, a song's never going to take down the system, but it can definitely, you know, produce new insights, show us new kind of images of intercultural kind of exchange. It can kind of, yeah, produce forms of individual and collective flourishing. So you've got a top-down argument that is pretty defeatist and fatalistic, that the minute culture takes commodity form, all of its radical potential is subsumed, right? But then you've got a perspective that from the bottom up that kind of understands how, like, you know, culture making always involves a form of commodification. They always, you know, by making this podcast, I mean, I don't know if either of us are getting paid for it, but nonetheless, it's you know, it would end up taking commodity form in some shape, right, in terms of the platforms through which it's shared, right? And that doesn't have to foreclose any, you know, politics. And as I say, that, you know, one of the tasks of the book is to kind of nuance our understanding of what cultural politics is, you know, and I work with, again, Stuart Hall, his notion, well, his take on Gramsci and war of position, which I think is such a really, still really resonates. I feel a bit embarrassed that I'm kind of speaking in, I shouldn't be embarrassed. I mean, it's a fairly established theory, right? And maybe it's out of fashion, right? That's what I would say. Maybe it's out of fashion. But for me, it still captures perfectly the cultural, political potential of popular culture. And what he's arguing is that what the cultural politics of popular culture is about shifting hegemony. And, you know, and it's like, you know, what you can do, no matter how incrementally, is shift hegemony through cultural production, whether that's making a film, a TV show, a book, a piece of music. It has that power to shift hegemony, no matter how incrementally it can do that. And what's good about that approach is that it takes the pressure off. It stops us from burdening a piece of art to transform society in its entirety, because no piece of art or form of culture is going to be able to do that. But it can shift hegemony. And the other thing he argues, which is really kind of, in some ways, kind of depressing, but actually doesn't have to be, is the idea that in that struggle for hegemony between what he calls the dominant culture and, let's say, you know, the subaltern or minoritized groups, is that there's never going to be a winner. There's never going to be an outright winner. And so, yeah, that does mean that we just exist in this permanent state of trying to shift hegemony into more favorable, progressive, radical directions. But, you know, if that is the model we're working with, then we can think about cultural production and cultural products, which are commodified, you know, which are cultural commodities, whether we like it or not. We can then think about what they can actually do politically, which kind of runs counter to that top-down argument of commodification of race, which is brilliantly articulated by amazing critical theorists, whether that's bell hooks or Theodore Adorno, you know, famously most scathing of the commodification of culture. You know, that's what I like. You know, that's why I wanted to produce a more nuanced take of what commodification does and what it's, which, yes, inevitably is about exploitation, but it can have enabling properties too.
Yeah, and I think that you do a good job of exactly not adopting either position, because I think, again, you know, it's become quite commonplace to accept the idea of kind of total commodification, which can mean that any kind of progressive valence can kind of go out of the back door and you feel unable to comment on the negative implications of commodification of culture. Do you know what I mean? Through a kind of ambient optimism or whatever else you want to call it, you know. And so I think retaining that, at least a little bit of that bell hooks kind of angle, it remains really important, and that's really apparent throughout the book. So moving on to the case studies, first I wanted to ask you why you chose these particular ones, and if you could explain what the case studies you choose are.
Let me just go to the contents page of my book. This was a hard task. I mean, one of the first things I've got, you know, the thing that I struggled the most with this book was the Anglo-centric perspective. You know, on the one hand, we get publishers kind of, this is not a specific reference to Sage, who've been very supportive throughout, but generally publishers can be like, well, can you make it more global? And often you're just thinking, you know, it just feels a bit, superficial and you know, but saying that, and I do write about this in the book and I do reflect on this, but you know, there's been this big push to de-westernize, decolonize media studies. And a part of that is to kind of, you know, challenge the Eurocentricity, Anglocentricity specifically, in particular, of media studies and media research. So I wish I could have, I think the book fails miserably at doing that. I think, or at least, you know, I've tried to bring in more international perspectives, but actually it's, I don't think it really does justice to, well, I mean, firstly, that to write a book that is truly global, I mean, that would be huge, right? You know, I mean, it would be insanely massive, you know, to be able to do justice to every international regional context. I'd be writing, it would be creating a monster. And secondly, you know, one of the things we really need to understand are that ideas of race aren't universal and they have a very local, national dimension to them. So the kind of the way in which race is made understood in the UK is very different to the way in which race is the historical, the history of race and race thinking in, say, South America and in India and in the Pacific region. You know, and they have very specific histories in each of those regions. And yeah, they do overlap, you know. And for not least through global cultural industries, you know, kind of the kind of very American forms of blackness have become the dominant form of blackness for even for people, for black people way beyond the United States, you know. So for that purpose, you know, I am working with a very kind of European take on, sorry, a very European history of race and race making. So the case studies, you know, do, I'm afraid to say, kind of come from that perspective. I looked at I thought about it in terms of, actually, do you know what? I thought about it in terms of what students write about, you know, what when in my experience teaching, having taught these topics for well over a decade now, looking at the topics that, yeah, students cover. So yeah, migrants, the media's treatment of migrants is a big, big issue, as is increasingly Islamophobia. And like the Islamophobia migrants question is quite interesting because they overlap quite a lot. One of the things I do in the chapter on media migration and racism is look at, yeah, the construction of the migrant. You know, firstly, the conflation of migrant, refugee, asylum seeker, but then also how the migrant is racialized, and, you know, how kind of the word Muslim kind of stands in for the word migrant and vice versa. I think a chapter, there needed to be a dedicated chapter on Islamophobia, though, and the big theme of that is on Islamophobia as a form of racism, because that's something that is debated. Is Islamophobia a form of racism? And you get perspectives from the far right who say, I'm not racist, but I just, you know, I have a problem with Islam. Islam's a, you know, a dangerous faith, for instance, but that, you know, somehow that's not racist. Similarly, though, you've got people from, you know, from a critical theorist point of view who's saying, actually, we need to take Islamophobia as a very specific phenomenon. And I draw from the people who actually talk about it in terms of its racializing forms. And of course, media play an absolutely crucial role in that. And so much of the popular culture we assume, we consume, you know, like the other is often Muslim, you know, throughout popular culture. So there's a chapter on that. And then there's a chapter which builds on the kind of amazing research and the history research that's been done on the commodification of blackness in popular culture and how one of the spheres of society where black people have actually been able to take hold is in entertainment and media and popular culture. And historically, there's some very, very dark, problematic roots to that, which this book explores, but which are now being reproduced, but also challenged by, you know, by black cultural producers in all kinds of complex ways. So that's a kind of looking at how blackness has become a commodity, which is used to sell products. But also, yeah, the radical forms of black cultural expression, which have been there throughout history and what forms they're taking in the present and what histories they build upon. So again, it's that stress on, you know, we haven't talked about it, but, you know, the big hook of this book is, you know, and I take this from David Hesbenhow, just those three words, complexity, contestedness, and contradiction or ambivalence. You know, those are the three words that kind of really, which he was applying to cultural production itself, but I think really applies to race-making practices and, in fact, other all kinds of, you know, forms of cultural expression and cultural production. So there's that. And then also there was a chapter on digital race and racism. And, you know, this was a really enjoyable chapter to write because it really allowed me to, yeah, dip into or immerse myself rather in like what is probably the most exciting field of research in race and media studies more broadly. And that is to do with like digital racism in all its forms, from like, you know, cyber racism to like social media and platform capitalism, you know, and how, again, you know, big hook of this is how race takes commodity forms in so many ways and how our ideas of race are embodied in a commodity form. Which is, yeah, is sounds so complicated, and it is really complicated, but really, really, I think really important to take seriously, you know, how ideas of race take commodity form when it comes to media. You know, I didn't write it in those terms in the book, but as I say it out loud, that's kind of what this book is about. So you've got histories, like I say, the kind of recognizing that racism and capitalism are two distinct historical forces that, as I do say in the book, are shaping race-making practices in really complex, contested, and at times contradictory ways.
To start from the end of those case studies, the chapter on the internet in particular, you do a really good job. As you say, it's super complicated, but you quite clearly relay out how like processes of racialization and actual racism are both features rather than bugs of the kind of like architecture, but also the economy and the participatory culture of the internet and Web 2.0. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there I'm drawing from, you know, the work of some really brilliant digital race scholars. Oh, no, you know, just digital scholars, period. People like Rhea Benjamin, Sophia Noble, Kashona Gray, I think is really brilliant. What they've shown us, it's not that the internet is this kind of neutral, just objective piece of technology that has, as you put it, has these bugs, which end up being, you know, very, very racist bugs. If I can put it in those kind of slightly glib terms. But the way in which kind of racism was a part of the development of those technologies. Charlton McIlwain wrote a brilliant book called Black Software, which is looking at the history of, you know, development of, you know, of tech and in the context of Silicon Valley, and kind of actually, you know, much like contemporary cultural industries had problems with, you know, institutional whiteness. And then the ways in which kind of black people were conceived in relation to the internet as well, as a kind of, not as the normative user, but rather a kind of problem that is to be fixed by, you know, let me put it in other terms, in a black community kind of posing issues and problems that can be fixed by technologies, right? So, you know, and then I think it's Rua Benjamin, he talks about the tendency to talk about the internet as this black box, for, you know, I think the pun's intended, but which kind of has racist inputs going into it, but produces very, not radically different, but intensified racial outputs. So it's trying to think about the people involved in the development of these technologies and the cultural biases they bring, thinking about how those technologies themselves become inscribed with ideas of race, like the very architecture of the internet being racializing, if not racist. And then thinking about the outputs that are produced in terms of the user experience, in terms of who the, you know, who is the normative user and how are other users treated. Using the work of Jesse Daniels, another really brilliant and important digital scholar, you know, it's one of the most really provocative questions in that is the internet an inherently white space, which, you know, seems really reductive and can't possibly be true in terms of the engagement, right, that the internet facilitates from all kinds of people. But it's still a really important question to consider because in delving into it, it really does help understand the experience of these new digital technologies as felt by, you know, black, brown, Asian people, other racialized communities.
And I suppose the internet also is one of the spaces where the ambivalence couldn't be more obviously to the fore in terms of its, in terms of the easily accessible and quite explicit anti-racist and social justice-ness that pervades a space like Twitter, but sits so obviously alongside, you know, some of the absolutely most horrendous racist media available. And you discuss Black Twitter as a way into this in some ways. And you use that as a way of arguing that online race-making practices can actually contribute to the undoing of race itself. And that's also something that comes back in the conclusion. And obviously that's kind of provocative as well. So I was wondering if you could talk to that a little bit.
The point, you know, what is the point? Like, is the point, like, do we need to represent racial others better? You know, is that our normative position? That doesn't sound, we want to stop the racist treatment of racialized people in media. That's, you know, I'm definitely on board with that. But when it comes to the question of how can we represent our communities Black, brown, Asian people better? That's a much more tricky, contested question. And one that actually is quite dubious from the outset, because it's assuming there's a correct way of doing these things or a right way of doing these things. And that's not correct. So what do we, where do we go from there then? You know, that's the question. And, you know, and I follow the work of like utopian black thinkers like Paul Gilroy, who says, you know, our task as anti-racists is to do away with the idea of race itself. So this is the kind of the big kind of contribution of the critical cultural approach to race, is that yes, race is a social construct, but yes, race produces real material effects. But the idea of race itself is a product of racism. Racism is the very, it's not just the feeling or belief that white people are superior to non-white people, but it's the idea that they are these things called races, that they are distinct and different. Not least different from the white European self. And so if that's what racism is, so it's not, so we start off with racism, we put racism in the center, and we see one of the outcomes of racism is this idea of race. So what can we do then? So for me, the only endpoint there is to just try and do away with race, the idea of race, or what Paul Gilroy calls raceology altogether. Easier said than done, right? Like, you know, certainly not an overnight project. Certainly not going to be something that's done in my lifetime. But nonetheless, that has got to be a goal. So I'm really interested in those. And then this is where I turn to representational politics. You know, as much as I've kind of stressed in this book, we can't just be fixated on representation. There's so much context that we need to explore in order to understand what race is doing conjuncturally, to use another famous cultural studies term. But I really, I love my favourite representations in scare quotes, so my favorite texts are ones which kind of play and toy and undermine and destabilize ideas of race. And you know, I know the third season of Atlanta is coming out, which is, you know, made by and stars Donald Glover, which is this kind of surreal take on kind of black urban life in Atlanta in the US. Which, yeah, kind of, it's kind of surreal and weird, as well as real at times, and yeah, destabilizes our assumptions around what blackness means and what blackness is. Again, another really important learning we take, like the critical cultural approach to race shows us, is that how our understanding of race, how ideas of race are built upon binary oppositions. So again, kind of forms of media, and popular culture and news that can destabilize those binary oppositions, not least dismantle them, all of a sudden can have produced really radical rippling, or at least rippling effects. And, you know, creating the conditions where more black, brown, Asian people can create these stories themselves for black, brown, Asian audiences who have been historically marginalized in a commercial media that doesn't see any economic value in them, let alone cultural value. If we can kind of improve the access for these groups to tell the stories that they want to tell in the ways that they want to tell them, you know, we can, again, to finish off on Stuart Hall's terms again, you know, we can widen that regime of representation, and not even widen it, but just, pardon my French, but fuck it up. You know, and I'm sorry, but I don't think there's a better way of expressing what, you know, the kind of radical cultural political approach I'm calling for. It's like, yeah, messing around and destabilizing these common sense categories of race that, yeah, still define our worlds, our social worlds right now.
Yeah, I think, I guess Atlanta's one of those examples of the like making weird and the making strange of that sort of thing, which I think is a really like promising and very prominent part of a lot of pop culture across different media as well, I think.
Yeah, and that's happening across the board, isn't it? Like, and the stuff that's happening around gender and sexuality, I think, is just the most exciting, radical, transgressive stuff that's happening in certainly in media, you know, media, the platform where actually the binaries between different genders are being exploded in like all kinds of radical ways and exciting ways, slightly unnerving ways, you know, for like middle-aged cis brown man like myself, but like, God, in this, you know, it's radical. That's, you can't say anything else about, you know, if there's one thing you can say about the new forms of like gender and sexual politics that are unfolding, is that it is radical. And yeah, and that's, so what can we, how can we create media that facilitates those kind of expressions? And we all benefit from that. We, all of us.
No, absolutely. So the final question I tend to ask people is, what are you working on now?
Yeah. Well, you know, like in the last few years, we've seen these, Joe Littler wrote a book called Against Meritocracy, which I really, really enjoyed. Oddie Mould wrote a book called Against Creativity. And I'm not going to work with this title because otherwise it's, but I want to write something against diversity. Actually, it's my working title, which is basically kind of an argument. And it's, so I'm going back to a kind of, I'm thinking about, right, because I enjoyed writing in this accessible, which I think is an accessible mold. You tell me if it is accessible mode, rather. I want to do something which is, yeah, maybe for like a general public, which talks about diversity, what diversity is doing and why diversity isn't what it's cracked up to be, and why actually diversity is precisely the problem in terms of racial inequalities in media right now. So that's what I'm working on. Yeah,
without that giving to,
yeah. I mean, I just want to stress, I'm against diversity, you know, from an anti-racist perspective rather than a kind of Lawrence Fox style. It's too much, or Piers Morgan style. There's too much diversity. It's very much on the other end of a political spectrum to those dudes. But yeah.
Well, maybe you might accidentally sell some books to the far right as well. And
yeah, I mean, God. I mean, if they're good for one thing, it's to extract surplus value from, right? So.
Well, we've got that to look forward to then. That sounds great. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Yes, Gummo. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.